This is the Voice of Freedom.
You have been seeing.
Oh, the times, they are changing.
Ladies and gentlemen, the corporate United States has declared war upon the citizens.
Burn that flag in protest. Now show me that.
Any general who ventures upon a battlefield without understanding the enemy is doomed to defeat.
Because I'm in a place of great knowledge about who's winning and who's losing this war.
I've learned some things, and I think these things need to be passed on to you.
MOX, what the fuck does that mean?
I guess you guys aren't ready for that yet.
It's a spirit, then, really, rather than a style.
Yeah. There's a friend of mine who's from Boston, and I recall him using this word gonzo in a sort of indefinable kind of way.
I've worked with better, but not many.
I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crying in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window. Open it, and stick your head out, and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Anybody got any questions? Just kidding. Thank you. Fuck you. Bye.
Champs fucking out, baby!
What's up, Pep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See, here on another Friday morning in America. Sorry about the absence. I had a bit of a medical thing that I had to take care of, and then I was on antibiotics that kept putting me to sleep for like 6 hours at a time, which made taking notes for the show really, really fucking difficult. Originally, the plan was to do... Actually, no, let me not just get right into business. Hang on a second. So, you may have noticed the a rather long intro for the show today. That was a bit of a thank you and an inside joke to like the, I don't know, 25 people who are gonna get it. I got the end of the year analytics for the show, and Come and See is in the top 5% of the most shared podcasts in the world, and in the top 10% most followed podcasts in the world, which is, I don't even understand how the fuck that's possible. We're in 35 countries. For the first year of a thing that I am literally doing entirely by myself, despite how often I say we and us, a thing that not even I'm sure why I do. That's fucking staggering, honestly. So, as kind of a thank you to all of the fans who, for some reason, seem to like what I do here, I put together a little thing that I could explain, but I think it'll be funnier if I don't. So that's a little from me to you. Thank you all very much. I love you. And if you would like to become a member of the Hep Cult, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com patreon.com/comeandseepod. There's a few different reward tiers for you, a few different options for you to become a subscriber and a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep Cult, which will allow me to pay bills and afford groceries and things of that nature. Because as Jeezy once said, Georgia power don't want to keep the lights free. I don't live in Georgia. Getting all of that out of the way, today's episode was supposed to be out a week ago, and it was supposed to be about the John Birch Society, but I decided, in part due to prescient current events, and in part due to the fact that I found reading the Big Blue Book of the John Birch Society god-awful motherfucking boring, I pushed that back a bit, and honestly, haven't we covered racists enough this season? I'm not done. But for now, I thought that I'd do something that I'd been really kicking around the idea of doing, but was trying to figure out a way to do, because I kind of already did it, in a way. Spoiler alert. Last season, we talked about Helena Blavatsky and the seven root races. Well, really five of the root races, because if you listen to that episode, you'll recall, I don't really deal in theoretical people, so we didn't talk about the sixth and the seventh root races. But there's been a lot, and I do mean a lot, lately in pop culture and modern media about Atlantis. So I'd been trying to think of a way to dig that back up, considering I'd already talked about it, but I didn't really focus on Atlantis, so to speak. It was just one of the five root races we talked about, right? So there was definitely material left to mine there, but I think that the biggest cultural entry point before Graham Hancock's fucking Netflix bullshit, I'll get into it, would have been the Black Panther sequel, Wakanda Forever, and Namor and Talo Khan, which I'm a sucker for those fucking movies, so I've seen that thing twice now. And I thought we could talk a bit about Black Panther 2 as kind of a Trojan horse to talk about Atlantis, because the Talo Khaneal and Talo Khan and Namor in Black Panther 2 are really just Atlantis. From Marvel Comics and from, you know, theosophy and pseudoscience. So that's kind of a way for me to pretend I haven't done this already, and hit some points and some interesting tidbits that I feel are necessary to discuss, and also have a bit of a talk about how Hollywood has this, I don't know, 50-year history of normalizing conspiracy in a way that I've always found kind of troubling, but I guess in the last few years feels like a bit of a ramp up because it's not fringe anymore, really. I mean, you could talk about the fact that one of the most famous men in the world talked to Alex Jones for 3 hours this week. I watched that, by the way. I'm not going to get heavy down into it because Dan Freeze and A Knowledge Fight just did like a 4-hour episode of their podcast covering it. I haven't even listened to all of it yet, but I'm very excited to hear the rest of Dan's takes. If you don't already follow Knowledge Fight, I do recommend that you go ahead and do that. The research that that guy does on Alex Jones is fucking second to none, and I think he's probably like the world's leading expert on Alex Jones at this point. So if you're curious at all what's going on with Alex, InfoWars, the yay thing, the fact that Nick Fuentes is suddenly everywhere all of a goddamn sudden, that was a weird thing, you know, if I can divert before I even start the fucking episode, that there were, what, 1, 2, 3 people who we've done units about on this show talking to Alex Jones yesterday for 3 goddamn hours, and that's just a thing that happened. The world is a strange and scary place, listeners, but hopefully you all feel warmer and cozier here. Probably not, because we talk about all of the things that scare the living fuck out of all of us, don't we? But hopefully In doing so, we dispel some of that and explain some of the pseudoscientific, pseudohistorical, and in fact Nazi bullshit behind most of this stuff. And today, we're gonna do that with Atlantis. So, I suppose, as I have a tendency to do, I should stop rambling and get into the material. Okay, here we go. Before I get started, there's probably two things that I should address up top. The first of them is, spoiler alert. And the second is that I understand and agree that there is a broader and necessary conversation to have about Disney and its monopolization of the film industry, about Marvel and, you know, for example, its advancement of pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist propaganda, anti-communist propaganda, fetishization of the military and use of military contracts to fund its projects, some of the terrible messaging in certain projects that they've had, like the Black Widow or the Falcon and the Winter Soldier. There's a lot you could say. I mean, you could talk about lack of directorial freedom, the McDonald's like way that all of those films are kind of the same thing. Look, I get it. But I'm not doing that. I'm a black person who very much enjoys that there is a black superhero franchise, because the few attempts at those, you know, like Blank Man, for example, Meteor Man is another one. There's also Spawn, except every time Spawn is human in the comic books, he's white, because ha ha ha, isn't it funny to make a black guy a white guy after he's dead when he wants to see his wife? Most examples of black superheroes aren't great, specifically in film. And Black Panther is one that seems to be, because it's handled by a black person with sort of an immersive sense of black culture, it feels like a win. Even though, yes, we could talk about the fact that there's monarchy, or the fact that the villain in both films is kind of anti-imperialist, although I think it's fair to say that Killmonger isn't specifically anti-imperialist, because he killed people on behalf of the military and the industrial complex, and wanted to be king so that he could use the resources of a monarchy to create a Wakandan empire. So it's probably fair to say that when you call Killmonger anti-imperialist, you're kind of missing the point. But what was I saying again? Oh, right. The anti-imperialist thing. In the second film, the antagonist, well, okay, they want you to believe that the antagonist is Namor and the Telekineal. I would submit to you, and I think that you could probably back me up on this if you've seen the film, I think the antagonist of the film is the United States government and the French government, much like in real life. So the film sort of opens addressing the fact that the titular character, T'Challa, played by Chadwick Boseman, has died. And I think that that's handled very well. One of the things that I always really appreciated about the first film was the way that it, like I said, immersively portrayed black culture, African culture, at least through the lens of a science fiction thing about superheroes with powers and shit like that. But I thought that the funeral segment was very beautiful. I love the way that they portray things like body modification and scarification as things that are African in origin, because they are. It's always nice to see that many black people in one place on screen, because honestly, it's not something that happens all that often. But the film, one of the, I think, central themes of the film is T'Challa's younger sister, Shuri, and sort of her struggling with the ideas of tradition, the memory of her dead brother, who was the king, the expectations of her mother and being a member of a royal family, those kinds of things, but also being a person who has an interest in science, believes that there is a logical explanation, a scientific explanation for everything, and harbors a lot of anger and resentment, particularly towards, it seems like, her ancestors, over not being able to save her brother. So there's sort of a very emotional component to the film, through her journey in trying to cope with loss, cope with her feelings surrounding that. And all of this, of course, is again in the context of a film where one of the main characters has wings on his feet. So they're juggling a lot of layers when you really look at the film, I think. And another central theme, I think, really comes down to the idea of Western exploitation of black and brown resources through the lens of vibranium, this made-up material that exists in the Marvel Universe that up until this film was believed to only exist in Wakanda, having crashed in a meteor thousands of years ago. It's what all of their technology is based around. It's what the Black Panther suit is made from. I believe the plant that gives the Black Panther his or her powers comes from vibranium being in the soil. So vibranium is very much interwoven into the culture of Wakanda in both the comic books and the films. And as such, all other countries want the shit because it's great for weapons. It's not detectable by metal detectors. It's extraordinarily durable. It's powerful. It can absorb shocks. So all other governments want this stuff, and Wakanda is, up until now, the only place that has it, and they won't give it to anyone because, well, history. And the film opens with a group of mercenaries attempting to steal vibranium from a Wakandan base of some sort, or a science lab, something or other. And it's revealed that they are there on behalf of the French government, and that this is a joint effort between the United States and France. And of course, I think that especially with the inclusion of Haiti in the film, understanding that the United States isn't the only country that fucked over Africans is an important part of history. Perhaps they could have included Spain. Maybe that'll be the next film. But with an understanding that they can't get this material from the Wakandans, the United States government, well, steals, in another exploitation of black ideas, black labor, and black invention, this device that was built by, you find out, Riri Williams, that can detect vibranium through any substance, be it water, other metals, whatever. And they use this because they think that there might be vibranium underwater. So they've been using this machine that's supposed to detect this metal underwater. And they find some. And upon trying to search the area where they've located vibranium, they are attacked, and everyone on this gigantic rig site is murdered by this group of Mesoamerican-looking blue people who are speaking Yucatan Maya. So that's your first introduction to you don't know what they're called yet, but they're Atlanteans, right? And it's actually interesting because I talked about on the mermaid episode of the show that there's sort of this confluence of mermaids and Atlantis, and I don't know where it comes from because historically they're two very separate things, and that mermaids typically have more to do with the sirens. Well, in this film, the Atlanteans, or as you come to find out, they're called Talokinil, have this audio hypnosis ability where they can sing and it makes people jump off of boats or walk off the side of boats and drown, basically, which ties these Atlanteans into myths of the sirens or old mermaid myths that we've talked about previously on the show. And I thought that was a very interesting inclusion, as was the fact that they were blue, which, by the way, for all of the white people who I've seen very angry about the fact that they're blue and not brown on YouTube, they are in fact blue in the comic books, but we'll get to that later. So you see these blue people who speak Yucatan Maya kill a whole bunch of government agents, and it's pretty fucking dope. And you're later introduced to their leader, who tells you that his people call him Kukulkan, and that his enemies call him Namor in, like, the dopest scene ever. And that these people also have access to vibranium, and that they've lived in secret because they're afraid of colonization due to experiences that, you know, that the Maya and the Mesoamerican people had with the Spaniards and Europeans in general, really. So there's his backstory. We'll get into that in a bit. He's introduced as the patriarch of the Talokanil people. He's 500 years old. He's a mutant. He has wings on his feet. And he has this kingdom underwater. Now, you find out later when the film shows you the underwater city that it is very Mesoamerican in nature, that the people of the Yucatan sort of during colonialization and a smallpox outbreak, they took a medicine made from a plant very similar to the one in Wakanda that makes them all sick and then makes them unable to breathe air, but they grow gills and they can breathe underwater. So they live underwater. Namor is the first one born since they've had this new evolutionary change brought on by this plant that was growing underwater near one of these pieces of vibranium, I'm assuming. And Namor is implied to be one of the first mutants, because this is in the 1500s, of course. And unlike the other Atlanteans in the film, he is not blue. He can breathe both underwater and on land. He can fly. He has wings on his feet. He is extraordinarily strong, nearly invulnerable. And, as I said, ages much slower. So all of that is going to be relevant when we talk about Namor's comic book origins in a little bit here. What the film really illustrates is a battle between a black and a brown nation over protection of resources that are trying to be stolen by Europeans. And ultimately, the two nations come to an agreement that they'll protect one another in the event that, you know, white people try to steal their stuff. Which is an interesting message, especially given how that isn't what happened in real life, geopolitically, for the most part. But it's always interesting to think, you know, pseudo-historically or whatever, about the possibility of if non-white cultures had the ability to band together in a substantial and meaningful way pre-colonialism, how that would have changed geopolitics moving forward. I actually once had an idea for a story about black people from the future going back in time to provide technology, weapons, and medicine to slaves, and how differently the world would look geopolitically if the United States had been divided up into territories based on former slaves being able to emancipate themselves, as opposed to having to be involved in kind of a proxy war between groups of rich people over whether or not it was okay to utilize free labor through the use of human property. But that's, you know, that's probably another episode for another day. We were talking about comic books, right? Anyway, the film presents some very interesting questions about the future versus the past, the ideas of science versus tradition and ancestral worship versus Well, the lack of a spiritual belief system, it appears to be. And it answers them in its own ways. I don't necessarily endorse any of them. I don't talk about my own personal beliefs or spiritual practice in that way. So I invite you to see it and come to your own conclusions about those kinds of things. But as it concerns the Atlantean in the room, this fascinated me because it was a very interesting portrayal of Atlantis and the Atlanteans, and in a way that also offered inclusion to Mesoamericans in a way that really hadn't been done since that colonialist propaganda piece of shit Apocalypto, like 10, 15 years ago, which wasn't a good movie. I don't give a fuck what Martin Scorsese says. The idea that the Mayans and the Aztecs committed that much human sacrifice has no basis in history whatsoever. It's based entirely on Spanish colonial propaganda that was used because the Spanish had a rule, as I believe we discussed back in the zombies episode of the show, that once they abolished slavery, the only exception was if you could prove, quote unquote, that a culture engaged in cannibalism or human sacrifice. So all of a sudden, everywhere the conquistadors went, they were killing and eating each other. And as a result of that, there's this idea that the Mayans and the Aztecs engaged in lots of ritual human sacrifice and ritualistic cannibalism. And there isn't really evidence that supports that. So it's probably one of the better portrayals of that era of Mesoamerican culture and film that I'm aware of. I felt that the way that culture was paralleled to the struggle of the Black diaspora and sort of the idea given voice to that this is also a culture that dealt with slavery, colonialism, and those sorts of things was a powerful message to send, and tying that into Atlantis was certainly a choice. And it's one of many choices that I've noticed lately. So I thought that I wanted to really delve into the reading, as I'm prone to say, and see if there was any precedent for a connection between Mayans and Atlantis. And it turns out there's a lot of precedent for a connection between Mayans and Atlantis. But also, that's not how Namor and Atlantis are portrayed in the comic books. So I thought that before I got into the Mayan-Atlantean connection, I would get into a little bit about the comic book version of Atlantis and Namor, because if you're familiar with Helena Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, or you've listened to the episode that we did about Blavatsky and the Root Races, or Vril and the Coming Race, that whole run of sort of theosophical, pseudoscientific, pseudo-history bullshit that we did last season, a lot of the mythology and cosmology of the Marvel Universe is going to sound very familiar to you. And really, in order to understand Atlantis, but also just to illustrate my point, let's talk first about another Marvel property that's been turned into a film in the last few years, The Eternals, and how that really plays very, very deeply into the mythology of the Marvel Universe. The Eternals are a species of near godlike immortal bio-engineered beings that were created by the Celestials, which are essentially the pantheon outside of the pantheon in the Marvel Universe. They're beings made of pure energy that are stronger than any of the gods. They're stronger than many of the universal constructs as well, but if we get into outer space, what I guess you could call exo-cosmology within Marvel, will be here all fucking day. So I'm just going to focus on the Eternals and that sphere of things. We could do the Celestials at another time, more than likely. I guess it depends on how much weed we all have. So the Eternals were created by the Celestials, but I really need to go back even further than that. Before they created the Eternals, the Celestials actually experimented on apes. At the same time that this was happening, one of the elder gods, Set, attempted to have his reptilian serpent men blessed by the Celestials, who actually deemed the reptilians unworthy. Instead, they experimented on three different groups of mammals. The first sort of came out deformed and dug caves and caverns underneath the earth and began calling themselves the Deviants. They eventually would go on to found Lemuria, and their procreation with humans would lead to the creation of the Nephilim, or mutants, as they'd come to be called. The second group of mammals that was experimented on, their DNA and their genetic code was altered to give them a heightened level or likelihood of extraordinary genetic offspring down the line, basically creating the what would eventually become metahumans. And the third was a group of cosmically powered, godlike beings called the Eternals. So we have the Deviants, misshapen monster creatures who live on Lemuria and also dug a series of interconnected cave dwellings under the earth. You also have a basis for beings from outer space altering the genetic coding and DNA structure of apes to create what would become humans, and eventually the level above human, if you will, if you'd rather, another callback to a previous episode this season, and do that with metahumans, and also the Eternals. Are you still with me? I know that this is a lot if you don't read comic books, but I'm trying to go slow. So, the Eternals establish a city called Titanos 600,000 years ago. And a civil war breaks out between two factions of the Eternals. One faction led by Uranos, who is actually Thanos' great uncle, but that's not really pertinent information. It's just fun for you comic book nerds. But one of the two factions, which is led by Uranos, leaves Earth and decides to colonize a planet that would go on to be called Uranus. Some of these Uranian? I'm not sure what the that would be for people who live on Uranus. But anyway, they're attacked by an alien race called the Kree, who kidnap and experiment on one of these Eternals, and from that, they bioengineer the race of the Inhumans. Another race that I'm not going to go into right now. Stay with me. The Space Eternals colonized Titan, which is a moon of Uranus. On Earth, the group of Eternals left on Titanus split yet again, with one group seeking again to colonize space. The other spread around the Earth, establishing cities called Oceana, Polaria, and Olympia, while the Deviants ruled Lemuria with human slaves, a lot like the Anunnaki, actually. The Earth Eternals are frequently mistaken for Earth's gods and demigods. Their creators, the Celestials, would return to observe Earth's progress, and the Deviants actually attack the Celestials, who destroy Lemuria, sinking it beneath the waves in an event that would be called the Great Cataclysm, which causes a massive flood that also sinks Atlantis, but one of the Eternals, who would later be named Icarus, helps humans build an ark so the species survives. after the Great Cataclysm, the Eternals take a more active role in human progression, being responsible for myths about people like Merlin, Samson, and, again, Icarus. Prehistoric humans populated a city called Atlantis. Many of the descendants who lived there were their ancestors were those that the apes that were experimented on by the Celestials. And like I said, the cataclysm that destroys and sinks Lemuria also sinks Atlantis. And then 10,000 years later, mermaids appear. Mermaids, or as they're called in Marvel, Homo Mermanus, are descendants of the original Atlanteans, but they're blue-skinned and they have gills. But they still take on the name of their ancestors and call themselves Atlanteans. An offshoot of the new Atlanteans finds and begins to repopulate the sunken Lemuria, and they develop serpent-like features and they have scales. The Lemurian Atlantean species used magic and celestial technology to create vampires, by the way. It's wild how this is tied into everything. An Atlantean princess had a child with a sea captain who was born with wings on his ankles, the ability to fly, near invincibility, slower aging process, super strength, and the ability to breathe in water and on land. In the comics, Namor is much more Roman in appearance. His name is actually just Roman spelled backwards, and Atlantis in the comics is much more Greco-Roman as well. Namor was actually the first comic book anti-hero ever, and one of the first Marvel characters ever as well, first appearing in 1939 in Marvel Comics number 1. In his original conception, he had the telepathic ability to communicate with fish, and he was much more like Aquaman, but more of a badass, I think, and also predates Aquaman by, I think, like 25 years, actually. I don't think Aquaman appeared until the 60s or maybe the 40s. Either way, Namor predates like everybody. The character was created by Bill Everett as a water-based foil for Jim Hammond, the Human Torch, who was a fire-based synthesoid who would later join Namor and Captain America, actually, on a team called the Invaders that fought the Nazis during World War II. Namor differs from his movie counterpart in many ways. The most obvious is the Mesoamerican heritage of Talokan and its people who speak Yucatan. There is precedent for the Atlantean people to be Mayan or Mesoamerican, or at least for Maya people to be Atlantean descendants. Namor is conceived of as an underwater ubermensch, their words not mine, able to swim, fly, and also possessing the strength of 1,000 men. And he's also a vehicle for environmentalist issues, such as pollution. The Namor of the film says much more about colonialism than he does about environmentalism, although his first sentences do discuss how the water and the air are so clean in Wakanda because they kept everybody who fucked the land up out for thousands of years. Now, we discussed Helena Blavatsky's fourth root race in season 2, but they're really worth mentioning again. In The Secret Doctrine, HPB says that the fourth race were brown, but that they became black with sin. This seems to me, anyway, to be a reference, or at least a parallel, to something we've discussed a few episodes back, the Curse of Ham from Genesis chapter 9, which I'm going to read real quick for you. This is from Genesis chapter 9, verse 18. Quote, "The sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled. Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank some of the wine and became drunk, and he lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. May God make space for Japheth, and let him live in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Good for him. End quote. The "good for him" isn't in the Bible. I added that for dramatic effect. But that story is tied to something that we discussed on the Hebrews to Negroes review. This idea that originated in the antediluvian South, that God had cursed black people and made them black, and therefore there was a biblical precedent here in the idea that black people came from Ham, and the curse of Ham and the curse of Canaan suggested that God had cursed dark-skinned people with bondage. So there was a biblical precedent for Western African chattel slavery. And in The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky refers to the fourth root race as having had skin blackened by sin. So I think that that's an interesting reference from someone who's sort of known to study comparative religion in tying her Atlantean theory to the Bible, something that there is years and years and years of precedent for, in that Atlantis comes up quite often in Christian mysticism, Christian esotericism, and some of the more wackadoo versions of medieval theology. In The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky notes, quote, "Thus, two by two on the seven zones, the third race gave birth to the fourth race, men. The gods became no gods. The first race on every zone was moon-colored, yellow-white. The second, yellow like gold. The third, red. The fourth, brown, which became black with sin. The first seven human shoots were all of one complexion in the beginning. The next seven, the sub-races, began mixing their colors." A note, strictly speaking, it is only from the time of the Atlantean, brown and yellow giant races, that one ought to speak of man, since it was the fourth race only which was the first completely human species, however much larger in size than we are now. In man, all that is said of the Atlanteans is quite correct. It is chiefly that race which became, quote, black with sin, that brought the divine names of the Asuras, the Rakshasas, and the Datyas into disrepute and passed them on to the posterity as the names of fiends. For as said, the gods or devas having incarnated in the wise men of Atlantis, the names of the Asuras and the Rakshasas were given to the Atlanteans, which names, owing to their incessant conflicts with the last remnants of the third race and the sons of Will and Yoga, have led to the later allegories about them in the Puranas. End quote. Blavatsky also strongly ties Atlantis and Lemuria to the creation, cultivation, and documentation of magic. Ultimately, she and others believed that magic is what sank the city, in fact, although there are theories about a comet that we'll get to in a few minutes. Like many ideas in The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky shared a very contemporary interest in Atlantis. We talked a bit previously about Ignatius Donnelly's Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, which was itself partially inspired by the work of Augustus Le Plongeon, who explored the Yucatan. Donnelly posits that the Atlantean Empire, as he refers to it, was present in Africa, along the Mississippi River, the Amazon River, the Gulf of Mexico, the Black Sea, and the Mediterranean. And also that Atlantis inspired Asgard, the Garden of Eden, Olympus, and the Elysian Fields, and that the Atlantean kings and queens, like the Eternals, inspired the Greek, Hindu, Egyptian, Scandinavian, and Phoenician pantheons, and that Atlanteans built Egypt. There's a companion book to the Antediluvian Age called Ragnarok, The Age of Fire and Gravel. And Ragnarok theorizes that a giant comet hit the Earth 12,000 years ago, causing the destruction of prehistoric, highly advanced societies as humans were forced to become cave dwellers. Donnelly uses works from Zoroaster, the Picts, the ancient Greeks, and Hindus that bolster his comet theory, as well as the early belief in heliotheism, or sun worship, as resulting from, according to him, generations going without the sun as cave dwellers. Donnelly's work also focuses heavily on the more general idea of what's known as catastrophism. It's a geological school that was really popular in the 19th century that, thanks to Netflix and Graham Hancock, is now popular all the fuck over again. Catastrophists hold the belief that short-lived, violent, sudden events have shaped the Earth. It evolved at least partially out of the universal flood theory, which is an idea that dates back to at least the Epic of Gilgamesh in the 18th century BCE. And Atlantis is often, like most lost lands, tied to catastrophism and pseudo-archaeology, but we'll get there in a minute. Another of Blavatsky's contemporaries and a fellow theosophist, Rudolf Steiner, share Donnelly's catastrophist ideas about Atlantis and Lemuria and expounded on them in great detail in his work. Quote, "When we consider what the Atlanteans were able to do by their command of the life force," I'll explain it in a minute, "we can understand that such misuse must have had tremendous consequences. An enormous power over nature could be placed at the service of personal self-love. And this was what happened in full measure during the period of the fourth sub-race, the original Turanians. The members belonging to this race, who were instructed in the mastery of the forces mentioned, made manifold use of these to satisfy their wayward wishes and desires. But these forces put to such use and naturally destroy one another in their action. It is as if the feet of a man willfully moved forwards, while at the same time the upper part of his body desired to go backwards. Such destructive action could only be arrested by the cultivation of a higher force in man. This was thought power. The effect of logical thinking is to restrain selfish personal wishes. We must seek the origin of this logical thought in the fifth subrace, the original Semites. Men began to go beyond the simple remembrance of the past. They began to compare their various experiences. The faculty of judgment developed, and wishes and desires were regulated according to their discernment. Man began to calculate, to combine. He learned to work in thoughts. Whereas formerly he had abandoned himself to every wish, he now was asking himself whether, on reflection, he approved of the wish. While the men of the 4th subrace wildly rushed after the satisfaction of their desires, those of the 5th began to hearken to the inner voice. And this inner voice had the effect of checking the desires, even if it could not crush the demands of the selfish personality. End quote. That life force energy that he's discussing he has this idea that Atlanteans, unlike later versions of humans, didn't think in terms of thoughts so much as pictures, and they had this ability to use their mental pictures and manifest actual energy that could create things with their minds, and were in tune enough with nature that they could dictate the form and fashion in which plants grew with their bare hands. So the Atlanteans had some sort of a telepathic command over nature. And this is sort of the framework and the mastery of this attunement with nature is what would become magic, which would eventually sink Atlantis. Now, before all the theosophical stuff, all work on Atlantis, as we've discussed in the past, traces to Plato's work, and Atlantis being sunk into the sea by the gods as sort of an allegory for the ideas of nationalism and hubris. And even some of Plato's contemporaries speculated about what or where Atlantis might have been, with many believing that he got the idea from the Egyptians, which makes sense. Plato stole quite a lot from the Egyptians. And there is actually, maybe, Egyptian support for this idea. Maybe. Maybe not, but maybe. In the 19th century, an idea, or a theory, rather, began to develop. That's a dangerous fuck-off sentence, really. Surrounding a hypothetical seafaring confederation known as the Sea People. The idea is that this seafaring group, known as the Sea People, invaded several regions in the East Mediterranean, as well as Egypt, in the late Bronze Age, somewhere between 1200 and 900 BCE. To this day, their origin really remains unknown, but a relief that was discovered in 1855 at Medinet Habu, documenting year 8 of Ramesses III, shows this group invading Egypt. The term "people of the sea" to describe the invaders in this Egyptian relief was first coined by Emmanuel de Rouget, who was a curator of the Louvre, actually. De Rouget published his excerpts of a dissertation on the attacks directed against Egypt by the peoples of the Mediterranean in the 14th century BCE, unwieldy title for a book, really, in 1867. De Rouget would become the chair of Egyptology at the Collège de France and advanced and popularized his seaborne migration theory, which was then built upon by his successor, Gaston Maspero, in The Struggle of the Nations, which brought the idea to a significantly larger audience. The idea would later decline in popularity in the 1990s, but it has, you fucking guessed it, recently regained some ground in the mainstream. Some theorize that the Sea People may have been the Philistines, actually, which would make them Aegean in origin. The Philistines in the Bible actually capture the Ark of the Covenant until their temple is destroyed and 1,000 of them are killed by Samson. The Philistines were absorbed by the Neo-Babylonian Empire and they disappeared as a distinct ethnic group by the 5th century. The idea that the country of Atlantis was referencing the sea people has been suggested by some. Others, like Francis Bacon, believe that the Atlanteans were tied to the Mayans, and also the Bahamas, through conspiracies surrounding the Bimini Road. Both Ancient Apocalypse and Quest for Atlantis, Startling New Secrets, this show on Sci-Fi, and I think an episode of Ancient Aliens, all assert the possibility that the Bimini Road, a structure in the Bimini Bay, is, or at least maybe, evidence of Atlantis, an idea linked to something we've talked about in the past, pseudo-archaeology. Pseudo-archaeology is the interpretation of the past from outside the archaeological science community, which rejects the accepted data gathering and analytical methods of the discipline. Pseudo-archaeology tends to rely on artifacts in various sites, such as, well, most recently popularized Göbekli Tepe, the Gate of the Sun, Stonehenge, Easter Island, Chichen Itza, Machu Picchu, the Nazca Lines, the Great Pyramid of Giza, the Chinese Pyramids, the Inga Stone, Burroughs Cave. There's a fuckload of these. And of course, there's plenty of books that discuss them as well. One of them I read from earlier today, The Secret Doctrine, of course, Chariots of the Gods, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, Fingerprints of the Gods, written by good old Graham, Magicians, Morning of the Magicians is another one. There's plenty of actual, very, very specific ties of this to the Mayans as well, which I think is fascinating because of our discussion today about the Mayans. A really, really great example of this and Mayan culture is all of the weird shit people think about the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar, the calendar round, appears to have been based on two overlapping annual cycles, a 260-day sacred year and a 365-day secular year that named 18 months with 20 days each. As the 2012 phenomenon really got popular, the world completely forgot what the Mayan calendar was actually about and how it worked. The calendar also included what were called long counts, and these were created by priests at the time, and a single cycle lasted 5,126 solar years. From the time that this was created, the end of the solar years landed on 21 December 2012. Ancient hieroglyphics from Tortuguero showed that when the cycle ended, the Mayan god of creation and war is supposed to arrive. And some pseudo-archaeologists took that to mean that the end of the world was going to happen on 2012. And as we sit here, 10 years later, it's really hard to say whether the world ended or not, isn't it? I mean, look around you. But anyway, pseudo-archaeology really tends to rely on the assumption that the general public doesn't know that most of these things have been researched exhaustively already, to construct scientifically insubstantial theories to supplement various claims, and also relies pretty heavily on exaggeration of evidence, dramatic or romanticized conclusions, and the use of fallacy and fabrication of evidence. Chariots of the Gods, which I mentioned earlier and we've discussed in the past, is a prime example of a book that uses pseudo-archaeology, as is, as I said, Graham Hancock's Finger of the Gods, and that new piece of shit documentary he has out. A New Age belief system called Mayanism also endorses a lot of pseudo-archaeology and pseudo-history surrounding the Mayans. Mayanism is discussed in The Morning of the Magicians and, again, The Chariots of the Gods. But like most New Age belief systems, it doesn't necessarily have a specific belief set at all. And other influences would include Le Plongeon, again, and H.P. fucking Lovecraft, someone who you should definitely get ideas about brown people from, as well as another Come and See alumnus, Edward Bulwer Lytton, the author of Vril the Coming Race. The idea that Atlantis may have been Mesoamerican finds some support in Mayanism and the work of Frank Waters in the 1970s. His books, Book of the Hopi and Mexican Mystique, The Coming Sixth World of Consciousness. Do you ever want to give money to a white guy who writes a book called Mexican Mystique? It ties the Mayans into Atlantis and a prophecy about 2012. Mayanism often serves as a conduit to catastrophism, as well as eschatological ideas about a mystical apocalypse. Through ties to Mesoamerica through Mayanism, some have also theorized that myths about the golden city of El Dorado are actually referring to the lost city of Atlantis. The Atlantean Toltecs, similar, it's worth mentioning, to Telecanil, were a Mesoamerican brown-skinned descendant of the Atlanteans, who also, in theosophical teaching, became Malayans, Mongolians, and indigenous people. The actual Toltecs were probably the historical predecessors to the Aztecs, existing in pre-Columbian 950 CE. So there are a lot of these disparate ideas through pseudo-history, actual history, pseudo-archaeology, and the 19th century, which was just this free-for-all of nonsense by all appearances, that formulated the framework for both the Marvel Universe and this new portrayal of Atlanteans in this film. And while it is beautifully done and an interesting piece of representation, it is part of this new trend in film to include these pseudo-historical, conspiratorial, pseudo-scientific ideas and present them in a very positive light. And it's not specifically a new phenomenon, but it is something that I do think is picking up speed. You know, we can trace sort of the, in the United States anyway, tradition of subversive, conspiratorial, anti-government, especially film, kind of to the 1960s and 70s, following the assassination of JFK and definitely following Watergate, as like a period in the country's history where the general public's faith in government, law and order, and tradition kind of being shaken for the first time on a massive cultural level with a medium that was able to sort of crystallize that and present it in a way back to the people. And you got that in films like The Manchurian Candidate, like The Day the Earth Stood Still, a film that we now know was intentionally created to sort of platform communist ideals in a way that would be more palatable to an audience that's been predisposed to hate the ideas of communism. So there are all these films going back to the black and white era that introduce the idea of conspiracy that is being carried out by the elites that needs to be discovered, or an actual conspiracy. And of course, there's further examples of this in more exploitation films, some James Bond things, that 1990s piece of shit Mel Gibson movie called Conspiracy Theory that had black helicopters in it was another fine example of this. You could look at most recently the fact that they've turned J. Jonah Jameson in the Spider-Man films into Alex Jones in literally every sense of the word. The new Godzilla franchise had an underwater city full of reptilian-looking humanoids with a whole bunch of hieroglyphics on the wall. Also, the Hollow Earth theory and the idea that there is a secret world populated by monsters at the center of the planet that you can get to at certain places. and also a guy who hosted a conspiracy theory podcast. And then there's the Marvel thing and the Marvel universe and its ties to Theosophy and now the introduction of the Atlanteans. And of course, the Atlanteans are also in DC through Aquaman. And all of that stuff can be fun and light and happy and whatever. I don't care. But the thing that I notice in all of these films that I find troubling is the lunatic in his basement obsessing about a secret world runner conspiracy always ends up being right. There is no example in film or television of the guy who isolates himself to uncover a secret conspiracy about a clandestine organization or the law firm or the guy running for president or this evil organization or whatever that doesn't end up being correct. Even the Alex Jones pastiche of J. Jonah Jameson in the new Spider-Man things, what he's saying is ultimately correct. There is a masked vigilante running around and it's Peter Parker. Alex Jones was right in the film. And of course, there's tons of puff pieces about Alex himself out there. The X-Files took most of the material of Bill Cooper and turned it into a TV primetime phenomenon for like 10 years. It's unfortunately the reason David Duchovny has a career. So there's this tradition within Hollywood, and it's so funny when you juxtapose it with the fact that the right-wing media so quickly paints that, oh, Hollywood is the liberal Jew-run media and you can't trust it because they're trying to pitch you these leftist ideas. That in actuality, Hollywood has done more to normalize conspiracy and the ideas of people like Alex Jones. I mean, the man is in two Linkletter films, for fuck's sake. So it's an interesting idea to suggest that Hollywood is constantly demonizing the right, and Hollywood is trying to shut the right out, and Hollywood is pushing a liberal agenda, when in reality it's a lot of rich people putting reptilians and things like that in films, to the point that most people know the reptilian thing is a thing, but they're not sure what it is, but they have seen it on Saturday Night Live. And I find that troubling, because there is an anti-Semitic white nationalist, in many cases tracing directly to the Nazis, history with most of this stuff. And while Atlantis itself isn't inherently a Nazi thing, the Nazis were similarly obsessed with Atlantis, because the idea that ancient 10-foot-tall Aryan white alien gods who had mastered magic and technology and created a utopia existed, and that was their direct genetic ancestral line, was something that Goebbels and the Ananerbe were the Ananerbe was absolutely obsessed with being able to prove, because like we have discussed many, many, many times on this show, whether we're talking about magic or druids or the Black Hebrew Israelites or the Moors or whoever, Mayanism now that we can add to the template, lots of people feel inadequate and they want something that makes them feel special. And if they have to, in some cases, invent an entire field of geology and fake world history to prove that, then that's what they're going to do. And Atlantis has persisted for thousands of years because it has allowed various groups of people to lay claim to this invisible landmass that no one can find, that is allegedly the size of Libya and China combined, but we don't know where it's at. It's allowed lots of groups of people to say, I'm special. I come from this place. We just don't know where it is yet. Atlantis was just Hogwarts for the ancient Greeks, okay? That's really all this is. And whenever you get into Graham Hancock's cockamamie bullshit Netflix documentary talking about the catastrophic destruction of an ancient, highly evolved technological society, these are, as they are, always end up being just 100-year-old ideas that a crazy Russian lady came up with. Well, I'll be, you know, being completely sacrosanct, or I'm sorry, circumspect. She didn't come up with them either. She just put all of them in one book, one very dense, very aggressively dense book. Three books. She was a very long-winded person who liked hearing herself think clearly. At any rate, those ideas found their way into the framework of comic books, and not just Marvel. This exact same trace of the Lemurians, the Atlanteans, magic people, mermaids, etc. exists in DC. They just do it through one guy, Vandal Savage, as opposed to an entire group of people with the Eternals. But both the two major franchises in comic books use the basis of theosophy upon which to build a combination of theosophy and ancient astronaut theory, really, upon which to build the mythology of their universes. And I think that is endlessly fascinating. And, of course, the idea of lost lands has fascinated us for thousands of years. You know, we've talked about a few of them, but there are so many. I mean, there is obviously Atlantis, and there's Lemuria, and the Island of Mu that we've discussed. We talked about Kamari Khandam a couple of weeks ago. There's El Dorado. There's so many of these places throughout history that some group of people feels like the lot that they have, usually due to colonialism, or if you're European, due to boredom, I guess, or the invention of evolution and practical science, proving that you aren't, in fact, a magical species of god people. But this idea that there is a place that explains all of the things about myself that I don't understand, that prove that I'm the main character of the story. And you're not. And I understand that that's disappointing for various reasons, but it's fine to not be the main character. It makes going to the grocery store so much easier. I think that there is a place for magical thinking, fantasy, pretend, all of those things, but when they're being discussed by politicians and on the evening news and being normalized by multi-billion, if not nearly fucking trillion-dollar film franchises, these ideas were safer when only, like, me and a handful of other stone dicks on the internet knew about them. But since everyone knows about them, I guess we should talk about them so that you don't come to horrible conclusions and turn into Nazis. So that's what I was hoping to do here in discussing the roots of the fourth root race of Atlantis and how they tie into Marvel, into the Mayans, into a fucking partridge in a goddamn pear tree. I don't even know. Stick a fork in me, people. I'm fucking done. And that'll do it for our discussion on Talokan, Marvel, the Atlantis thing, at least for another 6 months, right, until they make another thing and I have to do this again. But for now, that's going to be it. So I hope you enjoyed that. I'm sorry that I left you for longer than I intended to, but we'll be back, same Mox time, same Mox channel, on Monday. I was thinking we'd have a chat about the history of the anti-vax movement. I was gonna do that later in the season, but the season's already gone on longer than I thought it was going to, so let's just let it fucking ride, am I right? So on Monday, I think we're gonna have a discussion about the anti-vax movement, and we'll build from there throughout the week. So we can look forward to having a talk about how, for example, the anti-vax movement actually predates the existence of vaccines in the United States of America, which tells you the kind of stupid that we're all up against. Yay for us. But until then, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. I don't know why that got weirdly positive there. That felt game showy to me. I didn't like that at all. The fuck was that? Jesus Christ, Mox, why are you being fake all of a sudden? You gotta notice the show's doing well, and now you're being fake with the people. This is bullshit. Come on, let's do that again. Chop, chop. Chop, chop. What the fuck? Anyway, I have been Moxie O'Brien, as I may or may not have mentioned. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
Finished.